Hi everybody, and welcome to the 17th, can you believe it, episode in the Song of Ice and Fire epic linear reread from Vassals of Kingsgrave, an offshoot of an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire, the longest running podcast dedicated to the works of George R.R. Martin, as are we in some ways, I guess. So my name's Bina 007 on the forums of APOIAF, and we have a lot of fellow podcasters on the episode today, so I'm going to let them introduce themselves, starting with Adam.
Hey, this is Adam, Drown Snow on the forum.
Hey, this is Amanda, Middle Cyclone on the forums.
Hi, this is Claire, Dark Sister 24 on the forums.
This is Matt, Varley on the forums.
Hey, this is Michael, I go as Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
Hi everyone, this is Nadia.
And greetings, mortals. It is Patrick, Patrick the Tall on the forums.
And hopefully at some point later today we'll be joined by Jackie, who's Joao Olivier on the forums. He's having, you know, there's always some poor soul who has weird Skype issues, and sadly it's her, but hopefully she'll be with us in time for her chapter. So today we are, you know, knee deep in Clash of Kings, which is exciting because when I last was on this podcast we were still Game of Thrones. We are going to cover the events of 18th of February 299 to the 28th of February. And that is Cat 1, Arya 3, Tyrion 2, and Arya 4. So only four chapters this week, but all the feels. So it just felt like Arya 4 in particular needed some space to breathe, so to say. We finished the last episode, which hashtag Greg hopefully is editing at some point. Subtle hint. On Sansa 1, which happened on the 10th of February 299, which is Joffrey's name day. So between that chapter and Cat 1, White Raven arrives at Winterfell to announce the autumn, so autumn has come, and Cat 1 happens on the 18th of February, so we've skipped forward four chapters to get to that week later. So over to Amanda with the recap.
Catelyn 1. The chapter opens with Catelyn describing Robb's new crown, which has been modeled on the old Kings of Winter's uncomfortable bronze and iron hat fashion. It apparently doesn't fit well or is uncomfortable due to Robb's constant adjusting. Robb meets with Sir Cleos Frey, who is such a beta male. He orders Cleos to bring Cersei his terms, including releasing Sansa and Arya, returning Eddard's bones with ice, trading the Stark Bannermen captives for Lannister captives, sans Jaime, recognizing the sovereignty of the North and the Riverlands Kingdom, and getting some highborn Lannister hostages that can be released once a year later. Karstark is disgusted and leaves to plot and kill the kids. Catelyn feels horribly guilty for pushing Eddard to accept the handship, which is not her fault, because he's an adult man who is bad at politics. I feel about Eddard the way Silence feels about Jon sometimes. Catelyn observes that Edmure is a nice boy and a shitty ruler who let the Riverlords, Bracken, etc., go home to get murdered and hostaged. Robb and Catelyn argue about the war, and Robb points out he can't back out because he'll be unkinged, and Catelyn points out more bloodshed will not bring your father back. Catelyn also points out more generous terms might have ended the war sooner, and that Cersei will only trade Jaime for Arya and Sansa. This argument's sad because embodies how little women are valued in the society, though I understand for political reasons, though it's still heartbreaking when Catelyn says girls are not important enough. Catelyn refuses to go to the twins, which would have been a potentially good roadblock for Walder, though I'm going to head that off at the jump because she could just be a hostage like they planned post-Red Wedding, or to go with Theon to be dropped off on his way north. She encourages that Theon remain a hostage and that someone else be sent to Baelon, but Robb refuses. She leaves Robb and goes through the Godswood to see Hoster and Brynden, who has arrived, and they discuss Hoster's decline and the comet, which Brynden describes as an omen of blood and death in the war. End of chapter.
So Kat actually had some good advice this chapter.
She totally did. Business.
Well, yeah. I mean, it would have been it was kind of like a Hail Mary, but in a sense, maybe not a Hail Mary, but a long shot that he would get Baelon with him. But then again, what would be the best chance he could have gotten off getting Baelon on his side? That would have been Theon, right?
But if he doesn't send Theon, Theon can't go sack Winterfell. No, he doesn't know that. No one can know that.
No one can know that. In the end, it's Theon's stupidity that essentially leads to that decision. Not even Baelon told him to do that. He didn't even want him to do that.
But the whole thing with Theon is the fact that Theon was always meant to be the insurance for Baelon's good behavior.
Yeah, but usually you send your wards, your hostages back, like after a while, and. And Theon is a man grown. He's not supposed to be a hostage so much anymore, really.
But what is the technicality on that? So when he takes someone as a ward slash hostage, Is there some age of maturity that they go back with? Do you not just keep them until...
We've heard about situations where you take hostages, like he took hostages from Dorne, and that was essentially as an assurance until there seemed to be peace in whatever region it was. So one could just think, especially because of Ned Stark, he would not necessarily have kept Theon for his whole life, not against his will at least. So yeah, would you just think that that Theon would have been released even soon enough at least, because he was man grown.
I just don't feel we have any precedent for that in the novel, which doesn't mean it wouldn't happen, but yeah.
Well, there's just other times where people take wars or hostages, and they kind of do it on the premise that as long as you guys are nice, you will get to be released at some point out in the future.
John the Fiddler is a good example. I don't remember his real name as like a Blackfyre, but Bloodraven takes him as a hostage post the filled lake uprising. I don't think Bloodraven ever releases him.
No, he kills him, doesn't he?
He's killed in captivity. No, he gets killed at the Masked Ball by some obvious Blackfyre conspirators.
So, but that's not necessarily a good example, though, because if you get killed by a third party, or you get killed because the people you're trying to extort are actually not keeping to the deals, then we wouldn't actually know if they would be released at some point.
Right, and I think a good comparison is just Theon as a ward, you know, air quotes, and like Ned and Robert as wards at the Eyrie. Like, there's one where it's like more implied as a hostage, like, okay, we're going to, you know, raise your kid and educate him and, like, you know, teach him how to fight and everything, but we'll take off his head if he rise up again. Whereas it's just more of an alliance based, and like, you know, even for his wards, he goes to war.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. It's a gray area, but it's just me that assumed that especially Ned would be a bit more lenient on that account, especially because, I mean, yes, it was like 11 years ago that the Greyjoy rebellion happened. So it's like a long, it maybe feels like a long time since. I don't know.
There's also, Eddard made that order to Kat when she was going to go north, but then didn't. That was like, hey, make sure you keep Theon in hand because you might need his dad.
Yeah, and what if Theon actually succeeded? Like, if the Ironborn, like, were like, oh yeah, we'll fight along with you, the North, if as long as we get our islands, that's fine. Like, let's do this. Like, what would have happened? Like, they would have sacked Lannisport again, probably would have brought, like, the Lannisters to back home to defend, like, their own land rather than going after Stannis, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it would essentially have turned the war very much in Rob's favor. So yeah, if it had worked, it would have been a really good move, but it didn't, so...
Yeah.
Shucks.
Did anyone like the little character touches that come all the way through Clash of Kings when people are interpreting the comments? So, of course, Edmure thinks, oh, it's red for Tully colours. Idiot.
Goddamn, everyone is bloody interpreting this comment. Like, it's just a fucking comment.
But I think it's brilliant because it tells you a lot about that character. So Edmure is all sort of, you know, full of himself and the house, whereas the Blackfish is old and cynical and says, no, it just bespeaks blood spilled on every side in the war. So I just like the way George uses it just in this very short way to give you little character flourishes.
Yeah.
Well, so far in every chapter, it's like, oh, no, it's red for, you know, blood and fire. It's red for Joffrey. And, you know, becoming king, it's red for Lannister, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's red for good something, and old Nan smells it and is like, no, it means dragons.
Who's right? Who's going to be right?
But is she right?
Old Nan!
Basically, everyone's just interpreting it with whatever is relevant to them.
Exactly.
But that's,
dragons have come back, but is that really why the comet is there? We don't know, it's just a comet.
So I'm going to ask you a question. Isn't that essentially what we all do in every situation where there's something that's up to be interpretation? Like maybe even George's books,
Patrick, are you saying that we're self-involved and narcissistic?
How dare you?
How dare you? I'm thinking just that we're very subjective in our opinions about characters and happening, like what happens in the books, so much so that it might be even up to interpretation of what sometimes happens.
Oh, totally. That's why you can have all the theorizing and stuff, right? So
No. I don't know about you guys, but everything I put out is very objective.
Oh dear. Maybe is this a good time to break conversation and just bring in Jackie, who managed to join us?
Yeah. Oh, perfect. Great.
Welcome, Jackie.
Hello.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
We can. Crystal clear audio. Okay. Anyway, proceed, everyone.
I don't know what else we really want to talk about with Catlin.
How Rob and Kat's relationship is changing.
Oh yeah. Good point.
Heartbreaking. He just dismisses her casually. Ugh.
Well, yeah, he's a teenager and his mom's trying to butt in.
I've always defended Catelyn's decision to release Jamie because at that point she has lost two of her sons and, you know, she's trying to get her daughters back and she's very, very desperate. But at this point, that still hasn't happened, right? It's just basically Ned has died, but that's it. Winterfell is still secure. Bran and Rickon are secure so far. And the girls, as far as she knows, they're hostages, but they're noble hostages, right? So, as far as she knows, right?
Yeah.
Even at this point, she's telling Rob that he should be exchanging Jaime for Sansa and Arya, which it would be a really bad decision, which would be like a shortcut to losing the war.
Well,
but is
there
a point to the war?
Yeah, the thing is, for me, I think that Jaime is, he's a great symbol of Lannister. Confidence and superiority in a sense, but he is not especially a good commander, as we've talked about before. So releasing him might not really win the war, really. And I think the situation is as it is right now, that you know that the Starks won't kill Jaime Lannister, but you don't know that the Lannister won't kill the Stark kids.
Yeah. And like them having Jaime hasn't really prevented anything. Like the war's gone on exactly like it would have.
Right.
Yeah.
Like in theory, it should have stopped when Tyrion got back right before the Battle of the Green Fork, right?
Yeah.
Like, okay, Tyrion's back. Okay, we'll go back home now.
Yeah. All right. Let's just talk this out and, you know, people be angry, but hey, no, like this is what they wanted.
Yeah.
Well, stuff happened in between. First of all, they mustered their army, so it's pretty hard to just march back without doing anything, especially. Second of all, Ned got captured and attacked by Jaime Lannister. So that's not a thing you just let go, especially not when you're already a bit up
in arms. Well, I mean, wouldn't that be part of it is you sit down and you talk and you find a way to get Ned back and you know, kind of, we'll go back to the north, have a good day. Don't come near us.
Maybe, but that wouldn't make a good book.
The problem is, even if you do let Jaime Lannister go, it's what would have happened after that? Rob's bannermen would not have been happy with him, right? They're the ones who made him king, and if he just lets Jaime Lannister go, it's Rickard Carstark would be out for his blood.
Yeah.
Which he is, eventually, right?
Which he is already, because Rob is considering, you know, peace. But it would be so much worse if, you know, he just lets Jaime go.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's been so many losses on the Stark side, on the North side, by the hand of Jaime Lannister, that his vassals would not agree to that deal, in any deal, because they just don't value Sansa's and Arya's life as much as they value their own sons and uncles
and heirs,
whatever's lives. And
they don't value the girls until maybe later in the books when they seem to value them quite a bit.
Yeah, the North remembers. Now, eventually.
But that's not
that's all we got left.
Girls left.
That's terrible.
It is terrible, but that's misogynistic for you right there.
Yep. But yeah, it's like the person who's constantly told, like, no, we don't want you, and then like, hey, you're the thing now.
Yeah, I remember you. Now I remember you.
Yeah, we've been behind you guys since the beginning, just so you know.
Mm. Claire, any thoughts on the chapter? I'll have to get a word in edgewise, I know, with these guys.
No, I just feel sorry for Rob. Like, I just feel like any situation, any kind of thing that he decides to do, it's just not gonna work for him. So I just feel sorry for him, knowing what we know later on. I just read this chapter just like, oh my gosh, like, oh, what do they do? Like, I just felt sorry for everyone.
The moment they crown Robbie, screwed.
Yeah. I was just about to say that, Amanda, like, that brings up the whole, like, you know, King in the North, like, you know, argument. It's like, now he has to, like, lead, you know. Ugh.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was going to say, too, that I was thinking today a lot about, like, democratic politics versus this kind of feudal stuff, but thinking he's as constrained by his electorate. Like, if he doesn't do, you know, he's under pressure from the Karstarks and this faction and that faction, and he has to keep everyone happy, and he's just as constrained as any modern leader. I also feel huge sympathy for him.
Not Obama. The Senate will block anything he throws up at him.
Jackie, yeah. Any thoughts on this chapter?
No, really just echoing what you guys have already said. And I thought it was, like, it kind of stuck out to me how clear George R. Martin, like, laid it out when Kat was like, oh, so the girls aren't important, are they? You know, and Rob was like, well, you know, gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah.
It's realpolitik, it's like, but it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's like in regular diplomacy, yes, but this is like wartime and things are more complicated.
Yeah, peacetime diplomacy, sometimes like a female, like a daughter or something, could get more done, like diplomacy wise, than a male heir could do.
Through marriage and stuff.
Through marriage and stuff, or just being very charming.
this brings up the opposite question though. Like, what if it had been Cersei that had been captured? Like, how much is Tywin valuing her?
Oh,
even less.
Wow.
As a Lannister,
like, oh, thank God, you got that bitch off my hands.
He'll value her insofar as, you know, no man left behind for the name of the family. He'll value her insofar as just to let her go to the dogs would be to cast dishonor in the family. So it'll be like a second order value.
Just kind of like a mine, you know, hey, don't touch.
Yeah, you have to think about, like you think about Tyrion. I mean, even Tyrion, whom he honestly has a lot of disdain for, it's like quite obviously that he has that.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. He even goes to war for that one. I mean, so that's pretty obvious that that it has, like, even if he even goes to war for Tyrion, then he would, of course, keep on going to war if they caught Cersei.
Well, Tyrion can still produce more Lannisters.
So could Cersei, I guess.
They wouldn't be Lannisters.
Tywin already has Joffrey, right? Which is
exactly
power, right? It doesn't really need Cersei.
Except for the name. I think he's such a prideful guy. Like, his kids are ruling the kingdom, but as Baratheons, I don't think he likes that.
No, but then again, he doesn't really count Tyrion as his son, his real son. He would never let Tyrion control Castle Rock. I mean, he said that.
I know, it's weird, right?
So that's not.
But at the end of the last book, he said, like, "Why are you doing this? Because you are my son."
Yeah, but that's we've been through that. A lot of us thought there was manipulation. Like, yeah, you're the son that I need right now. Kind of boosting his ego so he can go down and kick some ass.
I think it would be more of the case of, like, he wouldn't want people to know that you could kidnap a Lannister. You can put a Lannister in that position. So it'd be more of just kind of, you know, saving face, like, oh, how dare you? It wouldn't be because, oh my gosh, my kids. No, it would be like, how dare you do that?
Do you think he's just content to let Kevin and his kids kind of take over the Lannister name eventually?
Ooh.
Wow. Yeah, I think actually, yes. I think personally, I think he respects Kevin more than anyone else in the family. And I think, as we saw in the last book, that Kevin is almost as tough on people as Tywin was. So I think definitely that could have actually happened, that if nobody was left, then he would be okay with Kevin's kid being the heirs of Castle Rock.
if Lancel didn't become a shit.
Yeah.
Wait till Tyrek comes back.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And sits the throne.
Yep.
Okay, anything more on Cat One?
Nope.
New? We get the backstory on Harrenhal. Is that the first time we've heard it in this chapter? I think so. Maybe not.
I think we get it at like one of the flashbacks to the tourney at Harrenhal, right? I might be wrong.
And I think it's just a castle then. Like, they don't describe the process of how Harren the Black brokered the Riverlands and they all starved and died and all the horrible stuff. It was just like a castle where the tourney happened. Maybe a big castle. Yeah, I can't remember either.
Anyways, either way. So if no one's got anything else on Cat 1, then we move forward to Arya 3, which basically we just skip over a Tyrion chapter. And the chapter happens on 21st Feb, so basically it's just a few days later. And we are going to have Jackie, a.k.a. Joie Olivier, recap that. So, but before we get into that, you've not been on the linear reread before, right? So I'm not doing questions you've already done. Excellent. So how did you get into the books? How did you find Vassals of Kingsgrave? Have you done a reread before? Who's your favourite chapter? Sorry, character? All sorts of questions. Yeah, how do you get into the books and stuff?
Yes. I got into the books, actually, my friend was watching season 2 of Game of Thrones, and it was, like, the third episode or something, and I was like, well, I have the first book, should I watch this? And she was like, yeah, it won't be a big deal, just watch with us. And so I got spoiled for, like, the end of the first book, and, like, Khal Drogo being dead, and, like, the dragons having hatched and stuff like that. But I did read all the books, and this is my first reread.
Wow.
Cool. And how did you come across either Podcast of Ice and Fire or Vassals of Kingsgrave?
I came across Vassals of Kingsgrave from YouTube, like most new people.
So, which was your first?
Please don't say Patrick was on it.
I'm not sure. I can't remember. It was the Elaine chapter, I think.
Oh, okay. Ooh, so ooh, one of
spicy
the
spicy Sansa.
So yeah. One of the Feast Dance reread, or one of the show. The Game of Thrones.
No, it was the.
No, it was a spoiler chapter.
Ah, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, spicy. Okay.
No Patrick, I think.
No Patrick. No,
sadly, no.
It's just
so important to me.
It's just basically when Casey, aka Blue-Eyed Queen, I think, was on the forum on the podcast for the first time, she was describing the episode she'd had that got her into VOK, and Patrick was just like, well, I thought it was quite funny. It was like, was I on it? Is that why you liked it? Is that why you saying? Never
mind. It's okay if you did. You don't have to like keep it to yourself. You need to tell me.
No, I don't think Patrick needs his ego inflating more than it already is. Okay, cool. And then I guess the next question is, what's your favorite character or scene or anything?
Right now, my favorite character is Sansa, who I used to like really hate. Like the first time I read the books, I was like, oh my God, this is like the most annoying character. She's just always whining and like she doesn't do anything. And then my opinion got drastically changed. So
happy. Between me, you, and Nadia, this is like the Sansa trifecta of awesomeness. Love it. So let's get into Arya 3. Over to you.
All right. Arya and company continue on their way up to the wall, struggling with the bad roads. Arya is extremely paranoid after the encounter with the gold cloaks and sleeps clutching Needle every night. The boys theorize as to why the queen wants Gendry, and Gendry insists that he never did anything to no queen. Yoren declares that they are not far from the God's Eye, and that they will head west to cross the Trident, as the King's Road won't be safe for them. All the food from King's Landing has run out, and they are forced to poach and live off the land. Arya catches a rabbit, and Rorge calls her Lumpy Face, Lumpy Head Rabbit Killer. As they get further north, more and more guards and sentries are posted along the road to guard the crops and lands, and Yoren curses them. Let's see how well he likes it up there when the others come to take him. He'll scream for the watch, then he will. They come across a burnt village with carcasses of burnt animals and people that have been impaled on stakes. They find a woman with one arm, a bloody stump, and a baby girl. Hot Pie confesses, I never truly kicked no boy to death, Arry. I just sold my mommy's pies is all. The woman's pleas and the baby's crying really disturb Arya, and she rides as far as she can from them in order not to hear them. That night, the woman dies, and Arya drinks too much water because there's almost nothing to eat. She sneaks off from the camp to pee and sees a whole pack of wolves. One of them comes out from the shadows, looks at her, and then they all leave. The encounter scares her, and she feels like a little girl and wishes she was home. As she tries to fall back asleep, she hears the howling of wolves and maybe the faint sound of screams. Yeah.
Great summary. Thank you very much. Good job.
Very concise, precise, and short.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, is it too long? Like, I feel like not that much happens in this chapter that's, like, really significant. So I was like,
No, it was perfect.
It's more of a tone chapter.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, something I noticed is the anxiety that Arya has when she's like, holy shit, this convoy is going so slowly. And she's always looking back like, oh, when are they going to be coming up after me? And yeah, just the fear because there's something wrong in the Riverlands, essentially.
Yeah, and
especially at one point, with the burnt village. Sorry.
Oh, no problem. No, at one point, the scouts say, like, there's armored men that are injured or something, and so they go, like, way out of their way to, like, just avoid them, because they're like, oh, well, they'll take our horses, because we can't defend it, you know. So there is, like, anxiety, and then one other really sweet spot was when the old woman with one arm and a stump gets buried under the willow, the wind makes it sound like she's still saying please. Mm. A little bit of the feels.
Yeah. How about the wolves? Do you think it's like, because George Martin, he keeps on teasing us with stuff like that. You mean, we all kind of thought at some point that Arya would get back with the Nymeria and they would kick ass around Westeros, right? So do you think that this is sort of like an allusion to that, or is it just George missing Wiz?
I'm not sure if it is. I think when I read it the first time, if I can think back to the mists of time in the last millennium, I did think that, you know, I was really hoping for Nymeria to be reunited with Arya, because I was still in that sort of like non-utterly jaded burned mode that George has now put me in. But I think now on the reread, I never even thought of that. But yeah, you're right. At the time, it really did feel like he was living these little tantalizing clues of hope that maybe there was going to be a reunion. But at the same time, like reading it now, which is kind of what Michael was saying, you just feel, God, it's actually, the messaging is really negative. It's taking so long. It's kind of like, you know, the build up to a horror chapter, which with Arya 4, we know is going to happen because it's, you know, nature's in uproar. It's taking too long. Hope is slipping away. They're starving. It's all building up. I think it'd be quite interesting to read the build up to Yoren and sort of put it against the build up to some of the other kind of disaster chapters he has, like the Red Wedding. Because I think he always does put these one or two chapters before that kind of ease you into that feeling of doom and terror. Such good writing. Yeah,
he had to do that. I mean, that's why we swallow those horses when they come. I mean, I think that that George needs to do these things for us to accept the horrors he's gonna bring upon us.
I agree.
That makes sense. I think the time when Eddard is in the Black Stalls is like an early example of that, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, in that specific situation is a little less like that than the others, because he kind of doesn't take your hope away slowly in that situation. He actually gives you hope while he's in the Black Cells about actually not being able to get out of this.
I feel like that was the entire Dance with Dragons book.
Yeah. Yeah, John's not going to get murdered. Definitely not. Whoops.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Because I thought it was just... Yeah, he did not tackle that situation very well.
Yeah, I feel like it's really great. I think, I don't know, it's like way ahead of now, but I think it's like, it's such a slow grind there. Like, I feel like it, rereading the John chapters and Dance, it's like, yeah, he's so doomed.
Yeah.
Can I go back to the wolves a little bit?
Yeah.
Sure.
When I read this chapter, I kind of was just like, what was even the point of having the wolves? Like, I don't, like, are they supposed to be part of Nymeria's pack? Like, is she supposed to be, like, connected psychically to all the wolves in her pack and, like, no, it's Arya? Because, like, that seems like a bit of a stretch to me. Or does she just come upon some random wolves, you know? Like, it just seems very, like, not really related to anything else.
Right, so in hindsight, it is more like, I think the spiritual connection, like you were saying, like she, you know, she sees when she's over in Braavos, she sees like through Nymeria's eyes and stuff like that. And later on, I think even in A Storm of Swords, but I feel like this really didn't have a point. And like, I agree with you. It's like, what was the purpose of this? Like, I don't know if it was just to show that like the Riverlands were like so fucked that like actually living prey, the wolves were like, well, there's a bunch of dead bodies over here that we could go snack on. Like, we don't need to deal with you.
Why wouldn't you much rather eat like slay and eat live flesh than dead? I mean, aren't animals conditioned, unless they're sort of animals of prey, like sort of albatrosses, whatever? Aren't they conditioned, or sorry, vultures, aren't they conditioned to want to hunt and kill fresh meat? Because that's better for them, less corrupted flesh.
Maybe. Crackpot theory, though. Maybe they can sense that Arya's a skin changer, a warg, and that's kind of what makes her different.
That's not that.
Well, that's why I say, like, in hindsight, like, that makes sense. But, like, if you're just reading this right now, it'd be like, what was the point of that scene?
Yeah, maybe. Like,
to tease the readers.
Yeah, it's Nymeria and atmosphere and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he's trying, definitely trying to get our hopes up for a Nymeria Arya reunion. I think and that's essentially what most people maybe focus on when they read it the first time. It's like, oh my god, wolves, they kind of bow down, so they must have a connection to Nymeria, right?
I mean, never mind the wolves. At this point of reading the book, at least the first time, at this point, I was completely convinced that Arya was going to make it back to Winterfell, or was going to make it back to her family. Like, she was with the Night's Watch. The Night's Watch were good people. She'd been saved from running around starving in King's Landing. She was on her way back. Yes, it might be slow, but it was going to be okay. It's Arya 4 that crapped all over that hope for me.
So, really?
Yeah.
I kind of really realized that the things were not really that going that well with Arya when I saw that there were so many Arya chapters. I mean, how many chapters do you need to tell the readers that things are going well and Arya's...
You can't read into that. You might still see the politics in Winterfell. Yeah, and also you might still want to see the action in Winterfell from her point of view, because she's our funny little scamp heroine that everyone loves, right?
Yeah.
She's getting a little dark, but yeah, I think at this point everyone's like, Team Arya.
Yeah,
I think that's the problem. That's the problem. Like, coming back to this text now that we know what we know, and after however many rereads we've all done, it's hard to kind of remember that innocence and joyful journeying that we did the first time. But I think at this point I was still pretty optimistic, number one, that the series would end within like 5 books that would be published by now, and and the Starks would somehow be sitting atop the throne. So yeah, what did I know? But Claire, do you have anything on this chapter?
No, I was just hopeful. I guess like everybody else, I just thought, Nymeria. And yeah, like, even though I had already kind of seen everything in the show, when I still read this, I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, hope. But yeah.
So when you, because you watched the show first, so when you were reading this and you knew what was going to happen to Yoren, it's kind of it's interesting to me that the writing's still powerful enough that you can still respond to that hope, even though you know what's coming.
Yeah, I did. I definitely, when I read it, I was just kind of like, oh my gosh, like, I just really, even though I knew what was going to happen, I was still just kind of like, oh my gosh, like, I really wish you made it home. Like, oh, Arya.
Yeah. And I think the show was doing a kind of shitty job with Yoren until, like, he had this one, like, scene with Arya talking about, like, I don't know, someone killed his brother, so he killed the guy, and that's why he got sent to the wall or something. But, like, really, like, cemented, like, that relationship and, like, made you more, like, sympathetic to the character. And I think that's why when you see him get killed, you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Whereas in the book, it's like, where in the book, it's the relationship is, you know, well-developed, and the character is, like, fleshed out, obviously.
Yeah, you have more time to do that. But I think the thing that at least did it for me in this show was when he was part of that chanting that she started. He was kind of the one who edged her on to do that.
Saying the names of the people.
Yeah, exactly. That was kind of the moment where I thought that he became more compelling as a character, because he gave that to her. So yeah, I think you're right that because of the books gives us much more time to relate to Yoren, and he does actively do more for Arya in the books than he does in the show. He becomes much more of a fleshed out character, right?
Yeah, he totally embodies that thing in Tolkien, the like some like foul things that appear foul can be fair and vice versa.
Mm.
I think we have a lurker.
Okay, so this chapter has been ranked on the Tower of Hand as 40 out of 70 chapters, like right almost in the middle. Do you think this is like, is it fair to put this in the middle, or is it maybe just like a symptom of it being like a chapter that's leading up to some big event and therefore not has so much on it in itself?
I think it's a little bit fatuous. I was talking about this with Matt earlier because we were talking about how awesome Arya 4 was. And, you know, if you were to rate your favorite chapters, this would have to be like one of them. But isn't it just a bit weird to kind of rank the chapters because so much of their power comes in what they're leading up to or from in a way?
Right. Yeah, there's not like standalones. Like there's standalone lines like, you know, the night was awoken with or filled with like the sounds of dragons, and it's like, oh yes, like that's the one. But you know, there's very few that just don't have that build up. Like, you know, the Red Wedding chapter is obviously very powerful, but you get those like two chapters beforehand of Arya almost getting there and Kat getting there beforehand, and then just makes it so much more powerful.
Exactly. The Red Wedding's a great chapter on its own, but it's made better by the build up. So these chapters are great servants.
Even in this chapter, the last line is amazing. It says, I don't remember it, but something about the screams.
Yeah, it was.
Oh yeah, it could have been the wind, or yeah,
it could have been the cries of men.
Yeah.
Or like on Monday's podcast, I had a brand chapter, and the last line was like, "The wide world was calling, and he knew he had to answer it or die." It's like, oh, that's a fucking great line.
Bloody hell, it's a bit grim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
When you remember that Bran is how old at this point? Like 7 or some shit?
Yeah, I think 8 or 9, but yeah, about there.
At the age of 8 or 9, all I cared about was basically lemon sherbet sweets.
I think
I didn't remember, that's midlife crisis for them.
Yeah, right? he's almost a man grown.
But isn't Arya only like a year older than Bran? So if she was eight or nine on when they were in Winterfell, wouldn't she be like 9 or 10 now, and then Bran would be 8 or 9?
Yep, it's still little.
I think Bran's 9 and she's 10. Because I think...
Well, wait, we're doing a linear reread. We have a whole spreadsheet. We can look this shit up.
Oh, my.
How much time has passed, Bina? Jeez.
Was George Takei just on for a second?
I can do a better George Takei if you want.
Go on, then. I want to hear the Danish.
Oh, my.
That just sounds like a really dirty old man.
Oh my. Yeah, I know.
Jesus.
We now have our bumper. Excellent. Anything else on this chapter?
Okay. Just one thing, like, okay, we see the like tide of humanity coming down the road and then it kind of comes to a trickle, but then there's still like guards posted by like orchards and cornfields and stuff like that, but there's like two guards with like hatchets and like a dude sitting in the tree with a bow. Like, do they not know about like the actual fighting that's occurring, or just want to protect their lands from like the travelers heading south? Because, you know, two guys isn't going to stop like the Lannisters or the Northmen.
Yeah, it might just
be
a local.
Yeah, I think it's just poor people coming along.
Yeah, they're
the road.
Peasants. They're dirty peasants. I mean, like the people, they're farmers, and they probably don't know the magnitude of like the reaving parties that are coming to fuck their crops up.
They're not in on the intel meetings.
They don't have like a raven tower or anything.
I mean, that's the basic message of this chapter, isn't it? That the poor, you know, it opens up with people being strung up on the side of the road, dying, and animals just slaughtered. And that's the basic message of this chapter. You know, ordinary people get screwed over and by war. So no matter how much of an idiot Robert was, at least he brought stability to the realm until he didn't. Oh, Nadia dropping the knowledge.
Fucking boars.
Bran is 8.5 at this point. Thank you, Nadia. By the way, Nadia, so, did we ever get a response from the Redditor when you asked about the whole Inn at the Crossroads thing?
No, we did not.
Boo. He can't handle the truth.
Pooey.
Was that the... What was that? Oh, okay. So that and we also had a question about the Dany chapter that takes, right, like over the Red Waste, that's like for months and months, but
We didn't know where to put it in the reread.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're going to put it in later on because of the... yeah, because it spans, like, several months, and I think...
Yeah, no, I mean, that I can kind of figure out, but I think the logistical stuff about where specific battles happen, and that's kind of more serious. That's more than just a sort of how do you split up the text question. Okay, so on to Tyrion 2.
So, Tyrion 2! Woohoo! Tyrion rocks! Yeah! We love Tyrion! All right!
Hey, Amber.
Hi, Amber.
What the fuck was that?
Yeah. I was fucking invited. I was invited here. And that's all I could think to do.
Not by me. Not by me, Amber.
Yeah, but by me, and I am the boss lady. So.
Hey, Amber. Boss lady. Hello, everyone. Where's Jackie? Amber.
Hello.
Where's Jackie? Hi.
They're the same voice. They're calling from the same place.
Anyone? Do it again.
What? Sound like Amber?
Do I sound like that?
Jackie, do you not think you sound... Jackie, do you not think... Like, to me, as a British person, like, I think you both sound very similar. It's quite spooky.
Nah.
Well, as long as the voice is a little deeper. More like than White Raven. And
who's
Doggy
talking
Dog,
right now?
Doesn't stand.
You'll never know.
White Raven. Okay, I gotta go. Bye. Bye, everyone. Have lots
Bye,
of fun.
Bye, Amber.
Bye.
Bye, Amber.
Bye.
Okay, so after a little non-linear skip to Amber, we go back a chapter from Arya 3 to Tyrion 2. So we're now 3 days later, it's February 24th, and it's over to Nadia.
Okay, so Tyrion 2. Tyrion hosts Janna Slynt at dinner with some great food and fine wine. He does his best to get Slynt drunk, which isn't really that difficult. They discuss who will replace Slynt as Lord Commander of the City Watch now that Slynt is Lord of Harrenhal. Slynt has suggested Alar Deem, his right-hand man. Tyrion wants Jacelyn Bywater, but Slynt tells him Bywater is too honorable. But Alar Deem is loyal and will follow orders and not question them. Tyrion asks about some trouble Deem had at a brothel, and Slynt tells him Dean was only doing his duty when he killed Robert's bastard daughter and a mother, but does not tell Tyrion who had ordered it. Tyrion also questions him about Eddard Stark's execution and why Slynt had let the execution go forward when Lord Stark had been meant to take the Black. When Slynt loses his patience, Tyrion quickly informs him he will be sent to the Wall and his eldest son will take his place as Lord, though he will not get Harrenhal. Slynt declares he will go to the King or Littlefinger or the Queen and walks away. But Tyrion already has Ser Jacelyn Bywater, the new commander of the City Watch, waiting to take Slynt into custody. Tyrion tells Ser Jacelyn that six other men are to accompany Slynt to the Wall, but that Alar Deem should be thrown overboard on the way. After they're gone, Varys comes to visit. Tyrion tells Varys he knows Cersei sent the gold cloaks to kill Robert's little daughter, but Varys already knows. Tyrion is furious because he can't touch Cersei yet. Instead, he must make do with punishing Slynt and Deem. They also discuss how Ned Stark's death seemed to be Joffrey's idea. Varys is glad that now Tyrion has the City Watch on his side, he can prevent the king from committing any further follies. They revisit Varys' riddle, but Tyrion still is not sure where true power resides. And Varys tells him, power resides where men believe it resides, no more and no less. Varys then brings out a list of people committing treason. The first is the captain of a galley who plans to offer his sword and ship to Stannis. Tyrion puts him down for a dose of Joffrey's justice. Also, the Red Wine twins have managed to bribe a guard to let them leave the city, and Tyrion sends him off packing to the Wall too. A jest Ser Balin Swan made is also on the list, but Tyrion decides to let that go. After Varys leaves, Bronn tells Tyrion he has recruited three more men, which I assume are the Kettle Blacks. Tyrion asks him whether he would kill a babe still at a mother's breast if ordered. Bronn says he would only ask how much he'd be paid for it.
So we knew Bronn was kind of like a scoundrel, but did anyone else, like, you know, estimation of him go way down when he's like, yeah, how much?
Hell yes. I mean, we knew he was a scoundrel and a mercenary, but I really, like, he really has no lower limit, right? So this is beyond what we've seen him do before now. So yeah, it did.
Yeah, and it kind of forebode the situation that is George is kind of underlining the sellsword of part of Bronn to the readers as well. He's trying to make sure that people, when Bronn essentially is going to not so much stab Tyrion in the back, but more like abandon Tyrion. You keep on feeling
it's
that
natural.
While he's telling us about, oh, that they're doing this stuff together, and Bronn knows all those secrets, and he's cool with all that and stuff like that. He kind of also wants to remind us that this is only fleeting still, because Tyrion has the money and the power. That's what he's trying to like anchor us in our hope that there might be a bromance brewing there, right?
Yeah. Bronn's not a lovable rogue.
No, not so much a sort of fantasy that like secretly Bronn is his friend and he'll always stick with him through thick and thin. But yeah, as we find out, that's not the case, which is really sad because
I think Tyrion's fantasy is show Bronn, right? Tyrion's fantasy is the buddy relationship they have on the show.
Yeah.
The show is Tyrion's fanfic.
But now I'm thinking about it, like, how does our estimation of Tyrion not change? Because he just ordered, what, two or three people's murders? Like, in the same chapter?
Those are adults, and they're traitors. They're traitorous scum.
Yeah, but those are actual murders. You know, he poses Bronn a hypothetical.
Yeah. I mean, there's always the thing with the protagonist of this, the point of view character is always kind of excused from doing heinous stuff that is not so bad. So it might just be that. I mean, a lot of people, including myself, kind of gave Tyrion a pass on a lot of the heinous stuff he did through the books. Especially, it's just mainly just when, like, later books, when he goes all drunken Tyrion and self-pity Tyrion, that you kind of open your eyes for what kind of nasty stuff that Tyrion's capable to do.
I think that's a great, it's a great point. And it's something I've always had about people's attitudes towards Arya and Tyrion, that by the end of where we get to, they're really quite questionable in their moral content. And I just think because we've loved them early, we give them way too much of a free pass as opposed to Sansa. So, you know, but anyway, I'm boring on that topic.
Well,
also,
I think
you go first, Adam.
I was bored.
Sorry, this is just going to be like kind of rehashing something from the last podcast that hasn't come out yet. But basically, I think that like the deal with Arya, and it applies a bit to Tyrion, is that they are both kind of victims in a way. They have horrible things happen to them all the time.
Sansa.
And like human I'm getting there. And human nature is that when we see someone victimized, we like to say like, oh, well, someone, you know, was going down a dark alley and they got mugged. Well, I wouldn't be going down that dark alley. It's their own fault, right? Because we want to feel powerful. We want to feel like it won't happen to us. And with Sansa, she does nothing, right? And she just, and we're like, well, I would never do that. I would stand up for myself, et cetera, et cetera. You see Arya, you see Tyrion, they're trying to kind of take it back. They're trying to go after people and not be victims. So I think we identify with that more than we should.
Bouncing off of that too, there's also the issue of like talking again about Tyrion and how like, and Arya, like how people say certain things, but then when they're actually put under pressure, they don't do the right thing or the good thing. With Tyrion, when Jan Oslin is talking about the Robert's bastard that gets murdered, the baby and the mom. Jano says, a good commander knows his men, Tyrion. Some are good for one job, some for another. Doing for a babe and her still in the tit, that takes a certain sort. Not every man do it, even if it was only some whore in her whelp. And Tyrion thinks, he says, I suppose that's so, said Tyrion, hearing only some whore and thinking of Shae and Tysha long ago and all the other women who had taken his coin and his seat over the years. And then you have that, and then you juxtapose it with Tyrion and Dance with, like, how rapey he gets and, like, how horrible he is to, like, and what he does to Shae. And, like, it's like, yeah, he has these, like, views, but then when he actually, like, when you put any sort of pressure on him, he just does horrible shit.
He's a great example about how we can all have these highfalutin ideals, right? But when faced with real tough decisions, what happens?
Yeah.
And to that extent, he's not that different from Tywin, as far as he's a real, real politic, it's pragmatic. He wants to keep the family in power and make them win in King's Landing as much as anyone else at this point, I think.
Yeah. Right, and there's got to be a fine line between like charity and discipline to like maintain that power. So they're willing to do like, you know, willing to protect a brothel, but then throw another dude overboard.
Yeah, but the person he's having thrown overboard just killed a baby. So
yeah,
I guess. At this point, he hasn't really ordered anyone's death who we should really be mourning.
No, it's very soon that the singer gets
killed. That's fucking gross, man. Because a whole bunch of people in Flea Bottom like just ate a person they didn't even know about it.
Well, they could have used the meat. They were pretty hungry.
Yeah.
Oh.
But still,
Michael.
That's such a George thing to do and say.
Yeah, but that's in a future chapter. We're not supposed to discuss that until before it comes, right?
Whatever, I brought up dance like four times already.
Yeah, right. I don't think there's a strict prohibition on it at all. Okay. Yeah, that's good. But that said, anything else on this chapter? Jackie, yeah. Anything?
Ooh. No, not really. I just realized how many people I'd forgotten about.
That's why we do
rereads. I had to go look up, was it Hober Red Wine or the Red Wine Twins or something? I was like, yeah. Who is that?
Horror and Slobber.
Yeah, Hobber
and, yeah, Hobber and Slobber.
Then their names are Horace and Hobber or something.
That's the sort of stuff I do.
Yeah, it's like when you talk to a show watcher, you have to remind them that you've forgotten more characters than they've seen on the screen.
Ooh, I love that elitism. can we talk about the opening sentence of this chapter, Amanda? You love it, right?
I mean, I think it's gross, but I think it's, I don't know, it's very visceral. I'll read it out loud just for the benefit of the listeners. Jano Slint was a butcher's son, and he laughed like a man chopping meat. I think it's both kind of I think it's kind of crappy writing, but I also think it's kind of funny too. So it's just like, I don't know how I'm divided on it.
Well, see, this is my point about this, that this chapter is not written from the point of view of George making a point. It's written from the point of view of Tyrion. So it implies that Tyrion is making a judgment about Jano Slint as a butcher's boy, that he thinks of him, therefore, in these gross terms. And, you know, because Nadia and I did these kind of War of the Roses, or, you know, like the British history equivalent to Song of Ice and Fire podcasts. And it just really reminded me of how the aristocrats of the Tudor era would really kind of snigger at people like Thomas Cromwell and Cardinal Wolsey as just being these kind of, you know, lower class butcher's boys who had aspired to great power, but no matter how many lordships they got and how many castles they got, would never truly be aristos. And I kind of felt that George was maybe making an analogy, because the butcher's boy, I mean, that is the way Wolsey is always kind of described disparagingly, and with actually that kind of language. And maybe he's making a point, like what Adam was saying, that, you know, in retrospect, Tyrion does have judgments that aren't as even-handed and as fair as we would like to think. Like, he's clearly an aristo judging this jumped-up little, you know, working-class man. But that's 100%. My interpretation. I don't know. I mean, feel free to disagree.
But wouldn't Wolsey be more like the High Sparrow, like in a institution that is like powerful, but he himself like came from nothing?
We don't know Cromwell. That High Sparrow came from nothing, do we?
Yeah, but
well, I mean, he pretends, or I don't know if he pretends or not, but like he wants to be the most humble person, you know, if that makes any sense.
But you know, at this point, Jano Slint is sitting in front of Tyrion as the guy who's owning Harrenhal, right? So he has gone from being a butcher's boy to someone who holds a great castle in the land. And
which would be more Thomas Cromwell, right?
Yeah, but both of them were butcher's boys who were then criticized for aspiring to high office. It's very analogous, and that's why Thomas Cromwell was very, per Hilary Mantel, was very loyal to Wolsey, because he related to him. So I think it's, I don't know, I just feel that the first few times I read it, I thought this is really cool. You know, George is making this really astute, it's just wonderful writing. But on this reread, I was like, but this is Tyrion thinking this. And Tyrion, who's the guy who we always think goes for the underdog, doesn't judge people by their physical appearance because he knows that he's judged for being a dwarf, is fair to women, is, you know, generally like a nice guy to Sansa. You know, he's the good guy, but even he's indulging in this. And it just made me respect him a little bit less.
So. Yeah, maybe. But then you got to remember that Jano Slint is a shit.
Yeah, but the fact that he's a shit does not derive from the fact that his father was working class.
No, but it might make Tyrion already dislike him so much that he grabs at any possibility to hate more on him.
Yeah, which is just prejudice.
It's hate-fueled prejudice, which is kind of like you.
Is there any other kind?
I think it's just one of those institutionalized things. Like, regardless of the way that he's been treated, it's still just one of those things of like, I'm still noble born. Like, at least I have that, and he doesn't.
Maybe. Exactly, Claire. I mean, I think for me, Tyrion, no matter how nice he is and empathetic, at the end of the day, he's still a Lannister, and a Lannister still values himself as a noble.
Yeah.
You know, he's so much description of the wine is common for George, and he goes over like the Dornish wines and the Arbor wines, and like Janoslyn can't tell them apart. And I also think that's Tyrion's view, seeing like, oh, look at this new money here, he can't even tell the wines apart.
Yeah, I could just be giving him $2 chuck and what do you know. Exactly. So Tyrion,
oh, Bina, I love the fact that you know about $2 chuck.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm a woman of the people. I too was a student once.
Okay, so another thing, what if do you think, I think the Tyrion, the way he, this is another example of Tyrion paying his way to relationships and the people in the relationships he pays for kind of tell him while they're in the relationship with him that they're gonna not like so much into it as he is. But he kind of wants it to be. He kind of...
Yeah, there's something very messed up about Tyrion that he can only have these relationships that are sort of commercially brokered in a way. And probably doesn't even realize he's doing it.
I'm sure he doesn't realize that he's doing it. He always pays for his things because he thinks that he might not think that he's worth like having a regular friend or something like that. I mean, the only person that he thinks that actually... he knows that loves him and respects him is his brother, but he's never really talked about anyone else in his family or anywhere else that hasn't been paid to like him, essentially.
Yeah, other than Jerry and Lannister, I think, who's such a minor character.
Oh, yeah. And then he goes away, right?
Yeah, to find Brightrar.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's quite descriptive that Martin is talking about how Tyrion again is trying to find common ground with one of his servants. I mean, Bronn is sort of like a servant right now, and so is Shay, just for different purposes. And then trying to become friends with them when George also makes it very clear that they're not in it for the friendship or the companionship. They're in it for the money.
Matt, did you have something to say?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Anything else on this chapter from anyone else?
No.
I guess we should clarify, with the benefit of hindsight, when Varys talks about saving another bastard, it's Gendry, right? Cool.
Mm.
More comet stuff, people going over to Stannis.
Sure.
People, you know, preachers starting to proselytize in King's Landing.
I always thought that, you know, Stannis was sort of fighting a lost cause because he didn't seem to have that many people around him. Like he had very few bannermen, and then all of the boats that they had sort of captured were trying to get away. But you hear about this captain who's in King's Landing who wants to swear his sword to Stannis. That was just surprising.
Mm.
Also, this chapter is like one of those George, like I think someone just mentioned it, but like really food heavy descriptive, like, you know, they're tasting different cheeses, you know, the Dornish and different wines and stuff like that.
It's not the chapter to read when you're on a diet.
right, because I want to eat all those things.
And I also meant like there's a food shortage reference. I think Tyrion says, yeah, enjoy this wine while it lasts because Highgarden's just closed off the Rose Road. And I think every time you're in a Clash of Kings, you're in King's Landing, there'll always be a reference in the chapter that there's not a lot of food in King's Landing. Yeah, build up to the riots and stuff.
But also, doing the linear reread in this order, like coming on the back of the last chapter where, you know, Arya and Gendry are having to basically catch and like, oh, would you like half of a rabbit's leg to share? We're so starving. And the Riverlands are so, not Riverlands, but the country's so ravaged. And then Tyrion, like, gorging on good wine and mocking this kid for not knowing, you know, good wine from bad and all this variety of cheese. It's just even more disgusting by contrast.
Yeah. Side note, do you think that the King's Landing is like a artificially grown city? I mean, you know, some cities they grow naturally and the food around them kind of supports the city to a certain extent. But it seems to me like King's Landing wouldn't be able, or the surrounding lands would be able to support King's Landing at all.
Well, it sounds like Stokeworth and, you know, the area like the Kingswood is like pretty fertile, but obviously it can't support the entire city, and it's mostly on imports, which, you know, I think most major cities are.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been like 300 years, and it's already grown to be like the largest city in Westeros. So one would kind of think that it artificially grew to this size, and not so much naturally as because of its positioning on the river or something else. A lot of the other towns usually in real world history have opened up because it's a lot of small towns have grown into a larger town because of the position of the flood, the river, whatever, makes the food so bountiful that there can't be so many cities and there's so many towns that would grow together to form a bigger city, right?
Right. So wouldn't that be like a city like Hong Kong or something, where it's an actual just an island and maybe, like, dependent on all imports, because obviously you can't. I mean, you could grow food on it, but not enough to sustain the entire city, right?
Yeah.
It's like all major metropolises, isn't it? Like, from time immemorial, you know.
Yeah, very few. All they have to do is be on trading routes at a port. Exactly.
It's like, you know, yeah, by definition, they support themselves through trade, almost.
Yeah.
So, on to Arya 4, which involves skipping forward 4 chapters, but just 4 days to the 28th of February 299. And this is, oh my goodness, this is the chapter that's going to bring on all the feels. And I do not envy Matt having to summarize this chapter, so over to you, Matt.
Okay, so they're still along the road, and they see a dead and bloated soldier in the reeds. And Yoren says, go check him for weapons or coin. And they find a little purse, and they find a couple of coins and a locket of blonde hair, which is just fucking heartbreaking. They continue on, and they find a village that hasn't been burnt, but no one's there. They stay in the hold fast. Sir Emery Lorch comes and sets fire to the town, and then they want to get into the hold fast, and Yoren puts up a fight and says, no, we're the Night's Watch, we take no part, all I have is young boys for the watch, go elsewhere, like, we're not gonna fight you, we don't want to, like, burn down the town, we don't give a shit. But Emery Lorch says, well, you guys are rebels, so we're coming in and killing you. So they start storming the walls, and Arya yells Winterfell, and Hot Pie yells Hot Pie, which is fucking awesome. Eventually they're overrun, and Yoren says, you know, tells Arya to get everyone out, get whoever she can out through the trapdoor, and he goes back to fight. So she gets Gendry, Hot Pie, and Lami, even though Lami's been stabbed through the shin or thigh or something, and the crying girl. And they go into a barn that's completely engulfed in fire and go through the trapdoor. And Jaqen says, boy, is it war? Is it red war? Like, a man can fight, which I thought was hilarious. And then later he's like, boy, let us out. Like, he just keeps on. He's very, like, he's very civil. Meanwhile, like, Biter at Rorge is like, get us the fuck out of here. And so Arya finds an axe, goes back outside, gets an axe, gives it to Rorge, and they break out and somehow become part of the Lannister party. I don't know how that happened, but that's later on. But her, Gendry, Lami, the Crying Girl, and Hot Pie all escaped through the underground tunnel. And a couple of times during this chapter, Arya, she bathes in the lake, and she says it smells like, you know, water and mud and life. And she says the same thing when she hits, like, the mud in the tunnel. She's like, oh, it smells like, you know, mud and worms, but life. And I thought that was particularly, kind of moving. And then I think that's all I have. Everyone's basically butchered. And we find out in the next chapter, you know, who was butchered. But even as they, you know, pled for mercy, they still got butchered.
Yeah, but it's 80 pages when you read it the first time that you don't know what happened to Yoren.
Right.
It's not good.
So then my theory is that because this book came out in 1999 and I was actually dating a blonde lady at that time, that George wrote me in as a dead bloated corpse.
What?
Because of the locket with blonde hair?
Yep.
Oh, brilliant. Can someone explain to me how does Yorin know that basically you can go through a tunnel in a barn and it's going to lead to the lake?
He found it.
The lake?
Has he found it earlier?
Yeah, he found it earlier and went and saw that it led to the lake, and that's why they put a cart over the door so no one can come in that way.
Okay. So it's not just that he's MacGyver, he just knows shit. Okay. You all thought that Yorin was dead the first time you read this?
I didn't think they would make it. But at the same time, I was like, Yorin, like, through all these chapters, he really, like, banks a lot of, like, this is the Night's Watch, everyone knows what we do. Like, everyone knows, like, the proper etiquette to, like, you know, even in the previous Arya chapter, he bitches about, like, having to pay for corn. And he's like, oh, we used to be feasted, like, up and down the Crimson's Road or whatever. So, I don't know. I think he put too much faith in that.
To see what Yorin's perspective of the previous war, Robert's Rebellion, was like, because I think he says in this chapter that he's been doing this for 30 years. And obviously
Robert's
Rebellion, there was no traumatic event like this that made him think, next time there's a war, I'm just going to take a fucking boat to the wall. He's like, no, the code, the Night's Watch code will take us to the Riverlands. We won't get slaughtered. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, and he says, was it this chapter or the last Arya chapter where it's like, in all those 30 years, he's only lost like 3 guys. It's like one died from the flu, one died when a snake bit him while taking a shit, and then the other guy tried to attack him during the middle of the night and he killed him.
It's a great chapter, though.
It's also another very unpleasant chapter to read as you get to the end, and Arya has to run through the burning barn and all the animals are screaming and there's smoke everywhere, and then she has to run out again to get the axe, and yeah, I'm like clutching my bedpost as I'm reading this.
Right, and she even, like, there's even that line, it's like, going back into the barn was the hardest thing she ever had to do. It's like, oh shit. Like, and things just got really intense. It was, there's great descriptive words where she thinks they're fireflies, but then she realizes that they're like torches, and then, like, you know, the village is going up in flames, and like how the soldiers' armors are reflecting those flames and everything. It's a great chapter.
Silence. Any comments from anyone?
Bloodraven.
Or are we all just doing 1 minute silence for Yorin?
I just really feel for her, especially the last line in that chapter, where she, like, just kisses the mud on the floor and, like, she just begins to cry and she doesn't even know who for. She just cries. And I think that's when I actually really, really started to like Arya, because even though she was a bit extreme, she, like, I think I always remember this moment as just her just being human and crying because she doesn't understand what's going on.
Yeah, so the line is, Arya held her breath and kissed the mud on the floor of the tunnel and cried, for whom she could not say.
You know, she's seen
it. You didn't like Arya since the beginning?
No.
Oh no, I did. I've always liked Arya, but it's just, I always just kind of thought, oh, okay, she's going to be like the kind of tough kid, and she kind of, like, she doesn't like anybody helping her and things like that. And I always thought she didn't get really attached to people, but just that when she cries, it just, when I first read this, I got a bit teary-eyed because I was like, crap, like, damn, Arya's crying.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's wherever you stand on the character of Arya. This is a devastating chapter. She's seen her father die, and now this only other, you know, she was saved by this other guy who she knows is a good guy because her beloved half-brother's gone to join his band, and she knows they're good, and maybe he'll get her home, and then it all falls to shit within a matter of, you know, a few months. It's horrible. It's just grim.
Right, and like we were talking about before, like, in the beginning of this chapter, there's, like, a certain, like, tranquility but uneasiness. Like, everything's too quiet kind of feeling to this chapter. And, you know, that makes the ending of the chapter even more, like, profound, I think.
I feel like this is just where
the hold past. It seems so unnecessary, something I noticed. Like, when Aemryn Lorch orders his men to go take this, like, a lot of them die. Like, Arya kills at least 3 dudes. And I just was thinking...
Yeah. It did seem a little unnecessary.
Yeah, like, a lot of your dudes are going to die taking this holdfast. You should know that, like, storming any castle or whatever is costly, but he does it anyway. It's just, You're an idiot, Amory Lorch. I'm glad you get eaten by that bear.
Yeah. I also think this chapter is a good demonstration of the fact that Arya has empathy, because I feel like people like to say that Arya doesn't have empathy and that she's like a sociopath, and that I really just don't think that's true. I think she's just like very traumatized, especially when there's this, it's like, this is one of those chapters where you just see her innocence getting squashed, because she when Amory Lorch and everybody are approaching the Holdfast, she keeps on wanting to be like, look with your eyes, can't you see? Like, she's so innocent that she doesn't think, she, like, can't recognize that Amory Lorch has no empathy and does not care. It doesn't even matter whether or not they are actually affiliated with Beric Dondarrion. He just likes to kill people.
I completely agree. Right. I mean, Arya has to have empathy at this point, because otherwise what happens to her as she becomes so
guarded,
hardened, jaded, whatever it is that she's going to become, but is the tragedy. If she started off basically as a natural-born psychopath who just had no empathy, it wouldn't be a sad tale. You know, she, at this point, she has to still have empathy, even for people like me who really question what she becomes without giving away stuff.
She even saves the crying girl, even though there's a line that's like, she wouldn't move even when she was slapped in the face. Like, but she still saves her. Whereas I feel like, you know, current Arya would be like, well, tough fucking luck.
Yeah.
I would have ditched her. I'd be like, fuck that. I'm getting out of here. I don't want no baby.
And I mean, even saving Lami.
Yeah, Lami, you also could have left him behind. He was obviously going to die from an infection. Right.
Also, we got to remember that Amory Lorch is a really good guy who killed Elia's daughter because the daughter kicked him, so he had to stab her like 100 times.
He's far worse than the Hound, isn't he? I mean, he's almost like the Mountain. He's
He's not a
nasty piece of shit, you know.
Yeah. Ugh. So I think he deserved everything that was coming to him later on.
Agree.
Yeah, if I could give that bear a medal, I would.
But okay, George always says there's some light in the dark, in the darkness. If just to theorize, what do you think that Amor Lorch's light side might be?
Well, his house sigil is a manticore, which means he must hold lands, which means that he's probably doing what he has to do to like maintain those lands so the people on his lands, you know, can eat, shit like that.
So you think that he's probably a fair and just protective ruler?
I mean, we don't know. We know, like, you know, Roose Bolton, you know, will rape Miller's wife, you know, just for getting married.
Exactly. Like, not everyone has a light side. The Mountain doesn't. Roose Bolton doesn't. I mean, there's no, like, redeeming, you know, soft, fluffy side to the Mountain. So.
Well, the Mountain has constant migraines, so it could be, you know, a psychological disorder.
Oh, it's not blame. I'm just saying that the light side doesn't exist, you know.
Right.
Okay, I'm just wondering. I'm kind of.
But God bless you, Patrick, for trying to find it. I appreciate the effort. Well, we can close out unless anyone's got anything else on Arya 4.
Yeah, I think there's one last thing for me. Yeah. I thought that it stood out to me that she called out for Winterfell, and that it later on makes Gendry like he thinks there's something up, right? But already to begin with, she must, I mean, I'm just assuming there's different accents and dialects from wherever you are from in the Westeros, right?
Right.
Either she sounds like a northerner or she sounds like a highborn girl, highborn person.
But what does hot pie sound like when he yells out hot pie?
It's yeah, I don't know, an overweight person from King's Landing.
Yeah. He sounds adorable.
Nailed it. Yeah, exactly. You want to give him a hug.
Yeah. So just
like I'm not the only one who knows what their battle cry would be, right? Like you've all thought, like what you would shout going into battle. No.
Okay. No. What's yours?
I'd be like, I'm going for a drink. Running the opposite direction.
This is totally a poll we should do on the podcast about some fire forums of best battle cries, because, you know, it's got to be fourth Aelingus, right? Okay.
Death and honor.
I have another thing. Was it this chapter where she's thinking about when they'll reach Harrenhal, Lady Went will help them out?
Yeah.
And there's this passage which could almost have been Sansa thinking it, and I'm trying to find it. It would be knights. Arya could reveal herself to Lady Vent, and the knights would escort her home and keep her safe. That was what knights did. They kept you safe, especially women. That's so sweet.
That's very Sansa.
Coming from Arya, it's so tragic, knowing what's going to happen to her personality, really.
Yeah, but you have to think about it. Like, essentially, Arya has been taught by the same person. Westeros values. She's been taught by Septa Mordain, which is a devout person, and would obviously tell her that knights are true and the seven are the best, or maybe not so much the seven because she knows she's in the north, but stuff like that, you know. Tell them the good stuff.
It's analogous to the whole Tyrion thing we were discussing, right? Like, Tyrion can be as subversive as he wants, but ultimately he's a Lannister, so he has some of those prejudices. And it's the same with Arya. Arya can, like, think all the needlework and all the stuff Sansa likes is silly. By the end of the day, she's still a highborn lady who had that education and who's going to think certain things. You know, you can't totally escape your upbringing.
Maybe not.
Okay, so now on the IM chat, for the benefit of the listeners, Nadia and I are debating whether For Frodo beats For Theolingus. I just want to change.
For Theolingus is, like, the best thing.
Well, it's in the books, right? Because For Frodo is only in the movie.
I know, but it's so, so moving. It just makes me cry.
It doesn't count at all.
It still counts. It makes me cry. But yeah, For Theolingus is fucking badass. Okay. So I think that about closes up the discussion for today. I would like to thank everyone for joining. So that is Amanda, Nadia, Adam, Jackie, Claire, Matt, Michael, and Sir Patrick at the very end. Last but not least, thank you.
Not very least. Not in the least.
I just want to say, if for those of you following along at home, there may or may not be a bit of a hiatus for this linear reread over Game of Thrones TV show. Just kind of depends how many TV show reviews that come out, because otherwise it gets a bit crowded putting out all the content. So we may be taking a 10-week recess, but if not, there might be one or two in the middle. But the next chapter will cover the events of the 3rd of March to the 17th of March, which is Sansa 2, Davos 1. Yay! Tyrion 3, Arya 5, and Bran 2. So for all the Davos fans out there, you finally get your guy. Has anyone got any podcasts coming up that they want to tout to the peeps?
They're all pending Greg.
We've got the Game of Thrones Season 6, our pre-show, which I still have to edit at some point.
Oh, cool. Is that like a dragon cast?
Yeah. It just went on for quite a bit, so it's going to be a pain to edit.
Cool. Anyone else?
Yeah, Bina and I are doing two different podcasts together with dates to be determined. We're doing Cold Comfort Farm, which we're going to be recording probably in late April. So if people are interested, it's a really easy book and it's really funny. We're also going to be doing, in May, we're going to be recording a podcast on the Cambridge Spies. We still have one or two spots available in that too. So if people want to read about Kim Philby and learn all about MI6 and stuff, it's really cool.
Yeah.
Is that a show or a book?
The Cambridge Spies, well, it's a historical event, but we're going to be reading the book A Spy Among Friends, which is a really good book, and everyone should read it if they're interested in, like, political intrigue at all.
Those were the Russian spies in Cambridge University?
Yes.
If you wanted to cheat, Matt, there is a BBC miniseries, 4 episodes now long, called Cambridge Spies. I think it was a BBC series. You could watch that and get up to speed.
No, I'm looking at a book right now, The Secret History of America's First Central Intelligence Agency, and I remember in there it had a thing about how English intelligence, like, basically... You guys taught us how to get intelligence from us, and then we were like, wait a minute, you're just infiltrated by the entire Soviet Union. So
yeah, the hilarious thing is you guys figured out that we were leaking stuff from our Washington embassy and told us we had to investigate, and we were like, oh, well, you know, none of us lovely chaps would ever do anything as treacherous and low-key as that, so we'll just investigate
like James Bond.
Yeah, let's just investigate all these kind of lower-class American chauffeurs and cooks, because it's bound to be one of them. You know, it's just ridiculous. I mean, I'm not even making that shit up. It's so dumb. So it's not our finest hour.
You're like, hey, let's put the guy who's leaking stuff in charge of the investigation.
Yeah, he was actually in charge of the investigation. So, yeah, not our finest hour, but it should be a great...
So, when are you guys doing that?
May?
May 15th.
It's a Sunday. May. Jesus.
Yeah.
It's because we're doing it... I'm finishing up my master's thesis over the next month, so I'm not scheduling anything during that. This is my last podcast for a little bit.
Yay. I'm glad you can make it. So, any other podcasts going on for anyone else?
Yeah, I think I'm gonna put up the notice for it this week. But it's not gonna be, we're not gonna record for it at least until after the Game of Thrones.
Sorry, that's the notice for what?
The Patrick's pet projects, and no, not Patrick's, but just the pet projects and pet peeves panel podcast.
Okay, the all.
Oh yeah, I like the idea of that. I saw that online.
The All P Super P podcast, super. Yeah.
And I think there's going to be a Doctor Who one recorded like next week or something too, maybe.
We're pending. Sunday night we recorded Batman versus Superman review.
Oh right.
Monday night we did the last thing of a reread, and I think there's The Revenant, and then if Shane ever gets the Penny Dreadful.
So there's a whole bunch of content, which makes me feel even more certain that we won't be doing rereads during the show, because it'll just get lost in the wave. But
And also, it's not usually not 10 weeks, it's 11 weeks, because of there's usually 1 week hiatus.
Memorial Day.
Memorial Day, yeah.
Yeah, so the whole world goes on pause because America has a bank holiday. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So it's probably going to be 11 weeks. But anyway, it won't feel like that because actually there's still the last episode and this episode to be edited and put out. So it'll probably be only like a month in between episodes at any rate. Okay, so just a few other bits of notice. We have a Cockney Moot coming up, so any listeners who are in England, or the south of England at least, on May 1st, which is a Sunday, it's the bank holiday weekend, a bunch of us are meeting up at Blenheim Palace. They're having a jousting tourney day. I think it's something like, from memory, 15 quid to get in, kids are welcome. So it's near Oxford, so not even in London, and I will be there, Erinies and Mr. Erinies will be there, Jedi White Heart, the podcast Bard will be there, Pops 88 will be there, Imogen may be there, so Tedard will be there, so Silence will be there, so a whole bunch of the English-based fuckers will be there, so if you feel like coming
along.
I am
jealous.
Yeah, it will be awesome. There will be jousting, there will be venison burgers, there will be... merriment and mead. So if you want to come along, grab a ticket, PM me, and I will let you know where we're gonna meet. The second thing to mention is that voting apparently is going to open pretty soon for the podcast awards, where you can both vote for A Podcast of Ice and Fire and Vassals of Kingsgrave if you should so desire. So look out for that on the forums, how to get involved. And I think that is it, other than to let you all know that I'm going to Northern Ireland in 2 weeks' time to go and visit all the Game of Thrones locations, and I'm super excited. So that's kind of it. Okay. Cool. Well, have a lovely weekend, everyone. Great podcasting with you for the first time, Michael, which is amazing. Can't believe we didn't do that before.
Yeah, you've done it for like three years.
Oh, no. Bonkers. Wow. And lovely to podcast with you, Claire. So,
You swallow
is that a Denmark thing?
Yeah, it's like swallow a camel, like to accept something that's very hard for you to accept.
You swallow a camel?
Yeah, you can.
Is that a thing?
It's a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
What?
It's a Danish idiom. It's a Danish idiom, really. But it's applicable in other, I think, because it just means that you have to swallow something so big that it's uncomfortable to swallow. And Right, Matt. I should have thought that. I should have realized that I was talking to you guys. Yeah. No, simply it's just...
No, really, just Matt.
Okay.
It's funny.
It is very funny. I know. But to get back to the semi-serious stuff...
Anything else on this chapter and or your battle cries of preference?
Yeah, I would just say the thing that would match most would be for death and honor. That
no, would be, because I want to be alive and win.
No, but it doesn't have to be my death.
Oh, okay.
That's the good thing about it.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point of war, right? Like, you just want to kill your enemy and not die.
No, you don't necessarily want to kill them. You just want to beat them.
No, you want to kill them.
Which involves killing them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like let's all go till we're tired.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, if women ran war, it would just be so much better.
100,000 people just slap fighting.
No, it'd be more brutal because if women ran war, we have a way higher pain tolerance.
This is also true.
Oh yeah.
We could be like real, you know, real sexist about it and just say they'd settle war over like knitting or something, right?
You haven't watched women's basketball.
Yeah, UConn.
Or yeah. Vikings.
I say to this day that, you know, the most savage environment I've ever been in is an all-girls sixth form common room, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There'd be no war. There'd just be passive-aggressive, like, back-talking.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't know. I think that women are just as ferocious as men are. They just kind of hide behind, like, all the stereotypes we men put upon them just to... get out of stuff, right? I mean, it's kind of easy to not be aggressive when men kind of have to be kind of aggressive, right?
I think what it is, I understand what you're trying to say, Patrick. Women are socialized to be a certain, like, indifferent, well, I'm just speaking to a Western, like a U.S. perspective, but like women are socialized to be a certain way just because of like patriarchy and the way our society has been structured with like dudes, because that's just kind of like the way it is. But at the same time, I feel like the movie Mean Girls makes many good points on this. It's like women have like layers of drama and aggression and plotting that like dudes have like no idea about.
Yeah
but that's I think that's essentially what you need, what a lot of people have erected as a substitute for plain old violence. I mean, yeah. if men were on the same was constrained by the same ideals as women were, I think, yeah, there would have been a lot more, much more passive-aggressive tendencies with men as well. But we're not. I mean, maybe late in, like, in now this post-modern society, we understand it more than we would have done. Like,
so just like Tyrion and Arya, we're just products of our upbringing and socialized and behaviors. Yeah, I agree.
It's society.
We have to.
A common theme of this podcast.
Yeah, we have to agree that men and women are not that different in the way we react to stuff. The only reason why we actually react differently is because that we've been conditioned from childhood to react.
Agreed.
Yeah. My high school English teacher, Miss Proctor's, I think summed it up best. It's like, boys will get into fistfights and become friends after. Women just give each other eating disorders.
Whoa.
Wow.
Miss Proctor's. Whoa.
I mean, was that?
I think 10th or 11th.
I mean, that's really dark, but not completely not true. It's just really dark. Like,
probably shouldn't be said in a classroom. So, just a quick postscript. Dustin Beckermeyer from the YouTube channel comments asked if we could go around and tell him our favorite and most hated aspects of the most important characters. So I think because there were two Arya, you know, we can't do every single character on every single podcast, but because we had two Arya chapters this week, maybe we would just discuss what we like and don't like about her. So Adam, do you want to go first maybe?
Oh, put me on the spot, are you? Okay. I don't know, like, I guess we've discussed kind of the negatives of Arya a bit today. Like, I don't think that I like her so much, maybe. that's kind of my negative, I guess. Like, I am way too quick to forgive her for the murderings or anything else she does because of her age and her circumstance and all that.
But I do like that she is a female in the world that hasn't quit and that didn't just kind of roll over for her circumstance, made something of, you know, her circumstances.
That's a lovely way to put it. Okay, Claire, any comments on Arya for Dustin?
I think, I don't know, I wish she was older, because I just feel like it would open up a lot more situations that we could see her in, even though the things that she does are pretty adult. But I just wish she was older. That's it. I don't really have anything negative about her.
She's probably one of the characters that suffers for George not having gone ahead with that 4 or 5 year gap he was planning at one point.
Because
I think he was probably wrestling with just what you were saying, Claire. It's really astute.
Yeah.
He really wanted to age people up, but didn't want to advance the story that much off screen.
Yeah. Okay, Nadia, what you like and don't like about Arya for Dustin?
Well, I love that Arya is this sort of little girl who does her own thing. You know, she's sort of this spunky little kid back when she's in Winterfell and it's just starting out. And, you know, she's a pretty smart kid when she's sort of escaping from King's Landing. She's a smart kid. She sort of doesn't get trapped. By whatever trap Cersei has set for her and all of that. That I love. But then it's not really about Arya's character. It's just not her as a person, but just she's just getting darker and darker and darker, and that's just, I don't like that.
Yeah, it's
hard to read. I just wanted to be that little girl who's, you know, just wanted to have an adventure.
Did she cut out?
No. Patrick, over to you. What do you like and not like about Arya?
Yeah, I think I like, and I also, I mean, the characters I enjoy the most are the characters that have adventures, so to say, that where stuff, actual little stuff happen in the chapter, so with action and adventure, whatever. So I like that her chapters usually have a lot of stuff happening in them. But I hate what me loving her as a character says about me, essentially, that I can look past all the clearly not okay stuff that she does and be okay with it because she's a point of view character and she gets kind of a pass for that and I catch myself in doing that a lot of the times and that I don't like that.
I think that's a really honest way of looking at it. Michael?
I think the thing I like the most about Arya is that she's just got no filter. Like, she just does stuff that you would always want to do, but you'd always hold back because, you know, there's rules in our world and you have to behave a certain way. And especially in Westeros, everyone is so restrained. But Arya just, she throws shit at Sansa and she, like, hits Joffrey. And it's things that you want to see happen, you know, like it's justice in a way. But yeah, she just does it. And I would also say that becomes the sort of thing I hate about her too, is that she has no filter or her restraints for when she wants to kill someone in the later novels. They sort of come out and she just starts killing people willy-nilly. So yeah, that's what I like and hate about her.
Yeah, nicely put. Matt Mark T.
Hello.
Yeah, you're back. What do you like and not like about her?
Okay. Well, I like that she's a tomboy from like day one. She doesn't want to do fucking knitting. Like, she wants to do her own thing, and I don't like that she eventually becomes psychotic. And by psychotic, I mean, like, she is, like, you know, going in and killing another person that she doesn't know, that hasn't wronged her personally, and that's it.
Yeah. So Dustin, I'm kind of where Matt is. I think it's great writing. I think she's an amazing character. To watch her character development is just, it's tragic. And up until really kind of almost to the end of the current published works, I really thought maybe there would be a path back of redemption for Arya, that maybe she'd be sent back on a mission to sort of save her family, like to kill one of her family, and wouldn't be able to do it. I don't know. Maybe I feel it's gone too far now, which would make me tremendously sad, because doing this reread, you remember, like everyone said, that she's the plucky tomboy who does say the things that we wish we could say to power, you know, truth to power. She's like the fun kid who does all that, and she's got a lot of courage. So it's just sad thinking Arya in that respect. But thank you very much for the question. Thank you for listening. And hopefully that was partly satisfactory as an answer. Cool. So I'm really going to end the call this time, guys. So great podcasting with you all.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Oh, Claire, you should check out the April Fool's episode of Podcast of Ice and Fire if you've never listened to it. Just saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Check it out. Bye, guys.
I'll do that. Bye.
Because it's all of us.
No narcissism there, then.
Either.